It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, when your business name becomes a verb, that's generally an indication that you've been successful. In the case of Google, the word successful would be a gross understatement. Ken Auletta writes the Annals of Communications column for The New Yorker, and he's the author of several books, including Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. His most recent work is Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, and it describes the history and significance of Google and its founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And Ken Auletta joins me by phone this morning. Ken Auletta, good morning, and welcome
morning.
To the program.
Good to be here.
Well, I want to start with the title of your book. What do you mean by the end of the world as we know it?
Well, the Internet, if you think of Google as a surrogate for the Internet, and or you just think of Google itself and its might, Google has changed the media world as we know it. If you're a newspaper publisher, if you're a magazine publisher, if you're a TV network, search changes your business. YouTube changes television's business, which they own. The Google phone changes the telephone business. Google Cloud Computing changes Microsoft's software business. So whatever business you're in, Google has had a profound impact on you. And I haven't even mentioned advertising. $21 billion of advertising flows through Google. That's as much advertising as all of the consumer magazines in the United States combined. And what they do is they only charge an advertiser based on people if they click on the ad. They don't charge them if people don't click on that little ad in the right-hand corner of the page. And so what that does is it provides a measure of how the ad is doing and how the advertiser is doing. So inevitably, they are beginning to bypass advertising agencies. So it disrupts them as well.
And I mean, Google is so ubiquitous. I mean, you don't even think about it. And when I read about the amount of advertising revenue that they have, and in comparison to other traditional forms of advertising, I mean, I was stunned. And I mean, I knew they were huge, and they were the big kid on the block, and all that. But I had no idea how much money they were bringing in. Advertising is what, about 97% of their revenue?
Yes. 97% comes from those little ads that you see on the right-hand side of the page. It's quite extraordinary. And some of us don't even click on it, but most people view those ads as information. And that's one of the reasons they're so valuable. So advertisers say, hey, this is just a great place for us to advertise and to target the people we want to reach.
You start the book with, I think, is an amazing anecdote where media mogul Mel Karmazin visits the Google campus, and he's blown away at what he sees. And I can't quote what he says at the end of his journey there, at least not on the radio. But let's just say he says, you guys are messing with the magic. Here's a great example, and I'd like you to talk about this, of the depth of the paradigm shift that we're talking about here, because here's an example of the, an icon of the traditional media, radio, television, film, that kind of thing. And newspapers, magazines, and he comes in to the Google campus and he sees all this stuff, and he's just completely blown away.
Well, he was the first traditional media, one of the first traditional media company executives. He ran Viacom, which then included both CBS and Viacom, which includes MTV, for instance, and Paramount Studios. He visits Google, and he was kind of, he thought maybe make a deal. He had heard about the company. He wanted to find out what it was, and you want to be more relevant if you're Viacom, a traditional media company in the digital world, so maybe we could buy this company if it interests me. So he sees them, and Larry Page and Sergey Brin and the two co-founders and Eric Schmidt, the CEO, take him on a tour of the Google campus and describe to him how Google Search works and what Google is up to. And as they describe the fact that you know, we don't have any waste at Google. You know, the advertiser only pays if you click. It's very rational. It's not emotional. And by the way, we give our engineers 20% of the time to work on any projects that they want. And we give free food out here and free medical support. And Mel Karmazin, a traditional cutting type executive, is listening to this and is absolutely appalled, not just by what he considers extravagant spending, but moreover, he's concerned when they say we want to get rid of the emotion in advertising. He said, no, no, I don't want to get rid of the emotion. I want to be able to sell the sizzle. I want to sell a Super Bowl ad for $2 million for a 30-second spot. And they say, no, that's inefficient. And they go back and forth, and finally, Karmazin looks them in the eye, his gold cufflinks gleaming, and he says, you guys are messing with the magic. And, of course, he didn't use the word messing. But what it meant was that they operated on two different planets.
Well, and that really, to me, that illustrated the whole culture clash that's going on here. You've got people trying to hang on to what they have, and you've got another group saying, you know, hang on to whatever you want, but we're going this way. It's almost as if Google operates in its own universe, and they're completely oblivious to other things that are still going on.
Well, what Google does, Google is an engineering culture. At Google, the engineer is king, which is why they get 20% to work on any project of their choice, which results in a lot of the innovation that Google does. But essentially what an engineer does is ask a question. How do we make this more efficient? So if you look at, say, advertising, you would say, isn't it very inefficient to charge, not know who's buying your product or looking at your ads, or to charge people based on tonnage rather than actual use of an ad? And isn't it really inefficient for a newspaper to be knocking down trees and building expensive printing plants and having trucks deliver their... Wouldn't it be much better to have an online newspaper? And all of the... Of course, they're right. It is much more efficient. So they are determined to make it more efficient. But what happens in the process is that you disrupt the traditional businesses and maybe ruin them. And if you ruin, say, investigative reporting or reporting teams of reporters, you know, in city capitals, then you've harmed a democracy.
Talk about Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the people who founded Google. How did they get together? How did they come up with the idea to start this company? What were they thinking when they first imagined this?
They met at Stanford Graduate School. They were both engineering students. And Larry Page had the idea to do, why can't we search the web? And instead of, you know, the web made information available. What Google did, they said, why can't we make information not just available, but accessible? So if you think about Google search as the equivalent 10 times squared of your remote control clicker, which allowed you to more easily interact with your television set. This and find channels. This allows you to find information on the internet. Sergey Brin, who was a math whiz, teamed up with Larry Page, and they created in their dorm room at Stanford a search engine. There were other search engines at the time, but in the end, within a couple of years, Google had the best search engine. And when I visited Bill Gates, and I tell this story at the start of chapter two, I interviewed Bill Gates in 1998, and I said, "Mr. Gates, what do you worry most about at Microsoft?" And I thought he would name some competitor like Apple or Oracle. Instead, what he said, I worry about someone in a garage inventing a technology that I've never thought of and that's going to bite Microsoft in the rear end. Well, in 1998, Sergey Brin and Larry Page were in a garage in Menlo Park inventing Google. And Google has actually become Microsoft's worst nightmare.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, Microsoft's in the search business. They have a 10% market share. Google has a 65% market share in search. Google is now coming at Microsoft, not just by creating a browser, Chrome, to compete against Microsoft's browser, Internet Explorer, but is also saying, you don't have to buy $300, $400 boxes of software from Microsoft. We'll give it to you for free or very cheaply in the Google Cloud, which is basically a server, like your email is on a server. And it'll be portable. Whatever device you have, wherever you are, you can access this, your operating system or whatever applications you want, not through a packaged software that takes time for your computer to churn up and get up and going, but immediately on Google's cloud.
Wow. Yeah, I could see where Microsoft would be concerned about that. So Larry Page and Sergey Brin come up with this search engine. That's all well and good, and it was a good search engine. How did they become so powerful so quickly? I don't know if you ever get used to the pace of change, particularly not the pace that we're moving at now. But even so, their rise was meteoric. Who supported them initially? Where did they get the money to really get this company off the ground?
What they did was they went in 1999. They were living on their credit cards at first, and the Stanford University computer system, and which kept on crashing because they had such good traffic on Google. So Stanford said, "Hey guys, you got to get either come back to graduate school and sell your company, or go off and build it. But you can't continue to dominate the Stanford computer system." So they decided to go off, and they eventually raised money in 1999 from the two largest venture capital firms in Silicon Valley, Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins, who put in $12.5 million each. And for the next 3 years, over 3 years actually, they lived on that $25 million. They had no income coming in. But they basically started with an idea. They said, look, if we really build the best search engine, and we don't do what the other search engines are doing, we're not going to have ads on our homepage. You're just going to see a white box, a Google box, which we're now very familiar with. But Visa comes to them and offers them $3 million to advertise on their homepage. They refuse. They said, we're not going to do that. And by the way, we're not going to do something else that Yahoo and AOL and others were doing. We're not going to build a portal. When someone does a search on Google, we're going to chase them off the Google site and send them to the information they wish, whatever site it's on. And third, we're not going to charge advertisers based on whether they just advertise. We're going to charge them based on whether the user clicks on their ad. And fourth, we're not going to allow people to pay to rank higher in the search results. What we're going to do essentially, and all these things add up to, we're going to build user trust. These young 20-some-odd-year-olds understood that the key to their business success was conveying to the user a sense that the user comes first. And when you're offering a free service, as Google is a free service, it makes it a little easier to do that. I think one of the reasons that Google succeeded is because these two 25-year-old-plus young men had the clarity of thought at that tender age to understand that the key to their future success was building user trust.
There's a saying within the Google Corporation, I think it is, don't be evil. What's that mean?
Well, they were looking for a way to define themselves for themselves and for the world. And so at a retreat, they picked a 12-person committee, and at a retreat, one of the engineers, Paul Volkite, said, I got it. Instead of all this gobbledygook that they were writing on a chalkboard, he said, don't be evil. That's it. We just won't be evil. Now, they loved it, and they put it in, and it became their motto. But when you think about it, it's really a kind of evangelical mumbo-jumbo. What does it really mean? I mean, if you lay off people, is that evil? Google laid off some people last year. Right. If you make a compromise with the Chinese government to restrict certain searches in China, is that evil? Well, it ain't good. And so it becomes kind of a myth-making enterprise, and it's not quite accurate to say. It doesn't mean when they compromised in China that they did evil, but it certainly wasn't good.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Google, and there's a new book about Google's history and its culture and what it means to the new media landscape. It's titled Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, written by Ken Auletta, and Ken is with us on the phone, and you can be too at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We'll be right back with more of our discussion and your phone calls. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, a look inside the private life in a military world, plus a report on what happened in Copenhagen. That's coming up later today on Talk of the Nation. This hour, we're talking about the new book, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, published by Penguin Press, and we have its author, Ken Auletta, with us by phone. You can be, too, at 800-642-1234, or by email at talk at WPR.org. We talked about, we've been talking about the corporate culture at Google, and one of the things that you pointed out, it's a company founded basically by engineers, and engineers are king at Google, which is part of the reason that they became so powerful so fast. But is there a downside to the dominance of engineers in at Google?
There is, but you're right. There's a plus and a minus, and the flip side of the vice is the flip side of the virtue. The virtue is that these are people who look at new ways of doing things and create new efficiencies that better serve users. I mean, it is very efficient, and I consider it a service to have all the world's information at my fingertips, as do you, as do most Americans or any citizen of the world. Or if you live in a developing world country and you can get, because you can't afford textbooks, you can do a Google search and actually get the information you need to substitute for textbooks, that's a wonderful service. On the other hand, the weakness of an engineer is they often lack emotional intelligence. That is to say, they don't know how to measure things you can't quantify. So, for instance, if people say, I'm afraid for my privacy. Google engineer, generally speaking, doesn't understand that. They can't measure it. If people say, I fear the size of Google, they tend not to understand that because they can't measure fear. Copyright becomes an encumbrance for them, something that interferes with their efficiencies. But copyright, I tell the story in my book of my conversation with Sergey Brin, co-founder, where he said, can I understand something? He said, why don't you just publish your book for free on the Internet? You'll get many more readers, won't you? I said, well, you might get more readers, Sergey. I said, but who's going to pay me? Would you ask a plumber to work for nothing? I mean, this and who's going to edit my book? And who's going to do an index? And who's going to pay my expenses to keep coming out to Silicon Valley and staying in hotels and renting a car and paying for meals? I said, that's my livelihood, and he didn't understand that, and partly he didn't understand because he thinks information should be free, which I don't. I mean, not if it means, you know, who's going to pay Martin Scorsese? I want someone to pay Martin Scorsese so he can continue making great movies. But the problem, the vice side of the virtue is that the engineer often doesn't understand some of the realities of the world.
Mm-hmm. We have people who want to join us by phone. Let's take a couple of calls here. Milton and Madison, you'll be first. Milton, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
John, do you use the word Google as a verb on the air? You do, don't you?
I have, yes.
Google was made popular by the media adopting the use of the word Google as a verb and giving Google millions, if not billions, of dollars of free advertising that their search engine competitors didn't get. The importance of this daily programming, especially by public media who are reaching technically more savvy people, the early adopters, can't be overlooked or minimized. I, for one, object to the use of my public airwaves to benefit a multi-billion-dollar corporation with unsavory connections to criminal governments at home and around the world. Google was started with CIA seed money, and a number of CIA people have come right out and said that Google is in bed with the CIA.
Ken?
I must say I'm totally mystified by that comment. I've never heard of the charge that Google's in bed with the CIA at all. And in fact, you know, I would think that's totally not likely. I mean, they are, if anything, they're hostile to governments, the people at Google. And I don't know of any seed money that Google got from the CIA or any other government agency, unless you go back and you say, well, the original development of the Internet 20 years before, 30 years before, was government-funded, Defense Department. That is true, but they weren't even born then.
Let's go to Milton's original point, and that is the idea that one of the reasons Google became so big so fast was that people in the media, I suppose that would include me, started using that term as a verb, and that's that led to their success. But that's sort of a chicken and egg argument, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, the truth is we use the term Google not to give them free publicity, but because they had the best search engine. And that's one of the reasons why they have a 65% market share. They didn't get the 65% market share because they tricked us, or because public radio or television or anyone else or the media advertised them. They have a good product. You do a search, and in 0.4 of a second on average, you get a search result. That's pretty cool.
Well, and it's not like the other companies that had search engines weren't promoting their search engines. Yahoo had a significant media presence, and they were trying to make their name a verb. Do you Yahoo? And Google just beat them.
I think that's right.
Let's see. Jay in Milwaukee is next. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. Ken is sort of tickling around the edge of my question without ever really speaking directly to it, the question being, where's their weakness? What's the Google killer? I mean, when you talk about the privacy, security, integrity questions, that sort of speaks to the question, where's their weakness? I don't trust them, for example. And when you talk about, information should be free as long as Google is plundering my content. I mean, if I want to sell mine, you know, that's a different matter. You know, my profit is bad, theirs is good. So how does all that get wrapped up into where's the great weakness that I can exploit to make my dollar or to expand my virtues or expand my, you know, cultural values? I'm not seeing it yet. What does Ken say?
I think that Google has the following vulnerabilities, among others. But the bigger ones in my mind, and I write this, I explore this near the end of my book. The lack of emotional intelligence that they often display means that they have three atomic issues that they have not been particularly sensitive to. One is privacy, two is copyright, and three is their size. Each of those issues excite government concern. Government is the 800-pound gorilla that can smack them down, the way government 10 years ago smacked down Microsoft. And Google has been late to understand that danger. And it's not just the U.S. government. For instance, the European Union is much more concerned about privacy issues than we are here. But they've got governments all over the world that are concerned about Google. We saw just last week they lost a copyright suit in France, where they said you cannot take French books and search them. So Google is waking up very belatedly to the threat from governments. In addition, many businesses have joined together to complain about Google's size and power, including Amazon, including Microsoft, including many advertising agencies, including many of traditional media that are really concerned about their size and reach and issues like copyright or privacy. In addition to that, when you ask what is the equivalent of the technology, the person in the garage that Bill Gates worried about in 1998, what's the equivalent for Google today? Well, one possibility is Facebook, a social network like Facebook, which has now 350 million users worldwide. Phenomenal growth. And if you think about it, if I'm doing a search and I'm looking for a camera and I do a Google search on it, and 0.4 of a second later I get back 20,000 results, well, that's a blizzard of information I don't have time to go through. If you think about it, it's really very inefficient to Google search. But if I instead can go to 15 of my friends or 20 of my friends and say, I'm thinking about buying this Sony or Samsung camera, what do you think of it? And I get back 15 or 20 responses from people I know who tell me this is a terrific camera or this is a bad camera, that is really a very effective and efficient search for me. And so that becomes using a Facebook or a Twitter as a search, what's called a vertical search engine, becomes a real potential threat to Google.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Stevens Point and talk to Rich next. Rich, good morning.
Good morning. This may relate to kind of the lack of emotional intelligence, but I'm in a business, and I won't tell you what business is, but I am paying for Google. If you search, I come to the top, and all you do is add, you know, a little more dollar. But, you know, we got this whole thing about review every business, and anybody can write anything they want, and you have very little recourse to rebut it. But if you come at Google from, like, Google Maps and click on my business, not only does my business come up, but below, they search for reviews. So it's a whole different set of data. And I guess, when I say they may not be totally sensitive, it doesn't quite strike me right for me to be paying for them to dig up dirt. And when I say,
well, let me be sure I understand. When you say you're paying them to do what?
Well, I'm paying them to put my, you know, if you search
to
my
advertise.
Business. Yeah, advertise.
There's, yeah, there's, under there's, the ads program.
I
right?
come up.
Yeah, so you're buying ads on Google, but at the same time, Google provides opportunities for people to review businesses. I think that's what he's getting at, is that he doesn't have any control over, no way to rebut those reviews if they're not good.
Well, you could respond, you can post a response to it, but, you know, if you believe in transparency, why shouldn't people be allowed to review his business? And Google is doing that, and actually, to their credit, they're doing it, even though this gentleman is an advertiser for Google.
It's one of the things I like about eBay is that the entire universe is based on reputation, and you can decide who you want to do business on based on feedback from people who've been their customers. And it's important to work really hard to make sure that you always have happy customers no matter what. Let's talk a little bit more about the development of Google as a business. I mean, they initially started out, and they were a private company. At some point, they decided to take the company public. They had an IPO. What led to that decision, and wasn't that kind of a risk? I mean, you know, here you have this company dominated by engineers, and they're doing a lot of things that are really non-traditional, and some things, and when I was reading your book, the things they do for their employees, boy, I was imagining shareholders just going right out, you know, right up the wall over, what made them decide to take the company public, and what was the risk there?
They went public in 2004 because they were required to. When you get to a certain number of shareholders, you have to become public. And that they had reached that number of shareholders, and they had to, within a year, become public. But when they went public, they did something unusual to insulate them from short-term considerations. They said, we're going to have two classes of stock, just the way the New York Times or Washington Post does, or Warren Buffett does, by the way. And we, meaning Larry Page and Sergey Brin and the management of Google, will control the majority of the voting shares of that stock. And this way, and they wrote a founder's letter to the public on the day of their IPO saying, we are going to stay focused on long-term. We're willing to lose money if we believe it's a good long-term investment. And even though it will not maximize short-term shareholder returns, we believe in the long-term be good for the business. And because we believe we are uniquely qualified to run this business as its founders, that's what we're going to do. So in order to insulate themselves from that kind of frantic Wall Street pressure, they created two classes of stock in 2004 when they went public.
And people bought the stock. Boy, I wish I had.
The stock, which then traded at $100 on day one, is now trading at around $600. So it was a pretty good investment.
Yeah. We're talking about the book, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, by Ken Auletta, published by Penguin Press. Google, just a fascinating company, and it's developed a reputation as being a really terrific place to work. I was reading, and I'm blanking on the number, when they have a job opening, they get a blizzard of applications.
They were getting a million applications a year, and they were hiring 1%, or they have now 20,000 employees.
It's Harvard, easier to get into Harvard, yeah.
Harvard's admission rate is 7%. So it was really hard to get employed by Google.
Why do people want to work there so much?
Well, there are a number of reasons for that. One, it's like going to college. It's a college campus, and you are pampered. I mean, you have free bus service to and from your work, you know, to and from work. You have free food, three meals a day. You get free laptops of your choice. You have a gym in every building. You have free massages. You have five doctors on staff to give you free medical help. On Thursdays, you get a car wash or oil change for free. You get a subsidy if you buy a hybrid environmentally friendly car. Now $3,000, used to be $5,000. And you sit in communal cafeterias. You work as teams. Your dress garb is t-shirt and shorts, and it's a cool place, and people love it, and they're treated well, and they get stock options, and they're very generous with their stock options, and so it's a place that people really feel happy to work. A question for the future is, as it gets big, and 20,000 is a big company now, will they be able to retain their best people? Because the tendency historically is for big companies to become more bureaucratic, slower, and because they're established, you get people at the top who've been there for a while, and if you're very ambitious, you want to go back to work for a startup where you have a better shot at more riches and greater responsibility.
Well, and some people who've worked at Google have gone on to do their own thing.
Absolutely, and that is something that worries them, and it should. I mean, that is what happens to most companies, that they become bigger and slower and more protective of their existing business, and people who are younger and still have energy and feel blocked in their upward ascent, you know, move elsewhere.
Well, you know, that conflict is the one you describe between Google and the rest of the advertising world. You have the big media companies talking, you know, content is king, and so they kept getting bigger and buying each other up. All of a sudden, recession hits, and here are all these huge media conglomerates that are leveraged to the eyeballs, and they're dropping like flies. I just read two more radio conglomerates file for bankruptcy yesterday.
Oh, you're going to see many more newspapers file for bankruptcy. It's just you are going through a period now where the internet and companies like Google have disrupted the old ways of doing things, and you know, it's not just them; it's the users, it's us. I mean, it is much more convenient sometimes to get information quickly on the internet. People don't want to wait till the next morning for their newspaper to come out, and you know, and they want so it just, you see the impact that cable television news has had on network news. You see the impact that cable networks have had on entertainment networks. You see the impact that YouTube has had on a number of television outlets. So it is just inevitable that as technology advances and people are empowered to choose what they want when they want it, that old ways of doing things will die, unless the traditional media tries to be more aggressive in creating a digital footprint.
You mentioned Bill Gates. Microsoft launched its own a new search engine, which it says is supposed to be better than Google, called Bing. Any idea how that's doing so far, and what is Google doing in response to this new development?
Well, what Microsoft did was rename its existing search engine Bing. They have gone. It's a good search engine. Whether it's better than Google is totally debatable. If it is, it's marginally better. So it's not greatly noticeable when you do a search on Bing, which is a good search engine, or search on Google, which is a good search engine, that they are so distinctive. And what since Bing was relaunched last spring, it has gained a little over 1% market share. So it's still at roughly 10% market share versus Google's 65% market share in the U.S. So it has not, so far, had a profound impact.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, lines available for you to call in and talk about Google, have a question about the company, or just a comment on what you've heard so far. Now's a chance for you to call in, 800-642-1234. And if you'd like to send an email, that's also available, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:42. Next up, Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller next hour. And after 11, Jim will be talking with the publisher of the 2010 Wisconsin Nature Calendar for Home and Cabin. That's Dennis Prusik of Green Bay, who's published the calendar for more than 30 years. That's coming up after 11. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller today. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. And my guest is Ken Oletta, who's the columnist who writes Annals of Communications in The New Yorker. He's the author of several books, including Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way, and most recently, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, published by Penguin Press. That's the book under discussion this hour. Before we go back to the phones, we've touched on this a couple of times. Google has had repeated copyright issues with authors when they decided that they should be able to scan all the books in print and make them available online. As a reader, I thought that was a great idea. Then after they acquired YouTube, they were sued by a number of content producers because people were putting copyrighted material on the internet. I mean, who ever heard of anybody putting copyrighted material on the internet? Good grief! They've had this issue, and the Associated Press and newspapers were concerned because their stuff was being made available, and they weren't getting compensated. You talked a little bit earlier that they just don't get the Google. I mean, just their leadership just doesn't see what the problem is. Don't they have any lawyers?
They have lots of lawyers, but they have a different definition. The battle of copyright is really a battle between two concepts which are not as clearly defined in the law. One is copyright, which is that for a certain number of years you cannot take my property, and you're only allowed to use a little piece of it. Where they differ is that's the traditional definition of copyright. The newer definition, which springs out of a culture, the internet culture, which says information should be free, they emphasize the phrase fair use. And by that they mean it is allowed for us to take material, for instance, to do a search of all the world's information. That is fair use. Because when we bring up the information you want, we then send you to the producer of that content. But the producer of that content claims sometimes that you're stealing my copyright. I don't want you to give a sample of my work, my book, for instance, they'll say, on the internet in Google Book Search, because people will just read that and they won't read the entire book. Google claims that's fair use. So the battle of what is the definition of fair use, which has never been adjudicated in court, is really at the heart of this battle. So when the book publishers sued Google, and now they've made a settlement, and it's before the courts to see whether it's approved, and or when they had a battle over YouTube, which they own, and Viacom said you can't download the Daily Show in some of our programs, and we're suing you for $1 billion, and that suit is still winding its way through the court. So there's a fundamental clash here between Google's definition of copyright or fair use, as they call it, and traditional media.
Yeah, and that would really expand the definition of fair use, because as I've always understood it, that was mostly intended for the use of educators in classrooms.
Yeah, but so you know, if for instance, if you want to quote from a song, or you know, you can do that, but only take a little piece of it, and so what little piece is acceptable without feeling that you've stolen the song, and
yeah.
That's a battle that always rages throughout history.
Well, it's the battle over the definition of how often is often.
You got it.
How many are a few? I'll know pornography when I see it.
Absolutely right. And you see what you're into here is the feel part of the business, the instinctive part of the business, the judgment part of the business that engineers are generally less schooled in.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Milwaukee, let's talk to you next. Mike, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'd like to know what the author thinks about the possibility of Google partnering with some of the real powerhouses. I'm going to use these terms that I've been hearing you people say, the creators of content. What would be the possibility of Google somehow partnering with an entity like the New York Times, a true creator of content? Because what I see today, so many entities called news are not really creators of content. They're just transmitters of content that are really created by other entities. So I want to know what the author thinks about that as a possibility in the future.
Well, there are two things. Currently today, Google does partner with the New York Times and with other media organizations in sending advertising to those. I mean, if you do a search and the clip relates to the New York Times, they then send you to the New York Times site where you can sell ads. So the New York Times gets roughly 12% of its revenue from digital endeavors, and probably half of that is from Google, so roughly 6%. But that's what happens today. And obviously that's not sufficient revenue to make newspapers like the Times whole. But in the future, the question Google wrestled with, and I tell this story in my book, they said, should we buy the New York Times or try to buy the New York Times? And they decided not to for the following reason, and it's a good reason. A reason that Google has such user trust is they are perceived as a neutral Switzerland. When they don't have a stake in what search results you choose. If they own content companies like the New York Times or some other newspaper or publisher, the danger is that if they start sending you to their sites first, they would lose your trust because you would feel like they're basically serving their own interests. And that's why they've decided to date not to buy a content company.
I'm trying to imagine the New York Times run by engineers.
Actually, one of the weaknesses of traditional companies is they don't have more engineers. I mean, if I ran a traditional media company, one of the things I do is hire an engineer I totally trusted and put that person right at my elbow. Because in the digital world, the engineer is a content creator. If you go to the Apple Store and all those apps for the iPhone, they're created by engineers. And they are creating things that occupy our time and attention. So it's content. And I think one of the mistakes that traditional media has made, and one of the reasons they've been slow to understand the internet and digital world, they didn't have enough engineers in their offices.
Well, I can tell you that the second rule of radio is always treat the engineers kindly. You don't want angry engineers if you're in the radio business.
Right.
So in radio, we get that. Engineers, right. We love you. I'm not going to say what the first rule of radio is. What was the most, as you were researching this book and as you were talking to the people at Google, I mean, you had access all the way up to the top. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered as you were putting this book together?
I think the most surprising thing was how two founders in their 20s had such clarity of thought. How did they know at that age, when everyone was saying that portals were the thing, you want to trap people in your portal, like Yahoo and AOL were very successfully doing at the turn of the century. And they said, no, that's not what we want to do. We want to chase them to where they want to go. How they come up with an ad program that basically served the interests of advertisers, where that you only paid if you clicked. How did they come up with an idea that they could build a team culture by giving 20% of the time to engineers to work on any project they chose, and to give all these free benefits to people that make their life comfortable and actually make them work harder. And how they have the clarity to say, we're not going to take ads on the front page of a Google search box. So I was just amazed at the clarity of thought and the choices they made while still in their 20s that turned out to be brilliant.
How did your perception of the company change as you wrote the book?
Well, as I reported the book, I came to see the vice part of the flip side of the virtue. I mean, the engineer was a virtue, and the search for efficiencies and this dedication to serving the user, which was genuine and idealistic. On the other hand, you were dealing with people who were not thinking about the consequences enough of their actions. What consequence does this have for newspapers or traditional media? And if, in fact, we inadvertently cause them harm, are we harming the democracy? And are we going to get in trouble with governments? And those are questions they didn't think enough about. One of the things that interested me about Larry Page, in a long interview I did with him, he talked about how he's thinking more and more about journalism today and how do we preserve it. And he stopped short of saying, and he said they didn't plan to try and invest in content, but he said, I really worry about a democracy if we don't have good journalism. Now, worrying about it and doing something about it are two different things.
Let's take another phone call. We'll go to James in Milwaukee next. James, good morning.
Morning to you. I'm wondering if the author had any conversations regarding Google Voice. I'm calling you over Google Voice. And I would put my question in this context. The communications industry dwarfs the content industry. Content is definitely not king. And yet, you know, most of the conversation thus far that I've listened to is around content publishing. It's certainly important, but did the author have any discussions regarding their plans for disrupting the telecommunications industry? I'll hang up. Thanks.
We had many conversations. By the way, I agree with your listener. Content is not king. Distribution is not king, which were two arguments that traditional media has traditionally made. And I would argue that Silicon Valley's argument that technology is king is not right either. The real king is the consumer, and technology empowers the consumer. I would also make the point that I think that anything that occupies your time, be it Facebook or Google Voice, becomes content, because it means time you're not spending on CBS or reading a book. And Google talked a lot about Google Voice and about smartphones and their Android operating system for these smartphones. And the reason they talk about it, it's tinged with a certain amount of frustration. They hate the control that the telephone companies exercise over phone calls and insisting on locking you into a two-year plan and insisting on controlling what applications you can use on your phone. And so one of the things that's actually new with Google and surprised me, when I did my last round of interviews last spring, they had made it clear they had no interest in being in the hardware phone business, building their own phone. They wanted to have an operating system for those phones. But since then, as of 2 weeks ago, they announced they're going to build their own Google phone. And they're doing it, I think, because they want to try to break the lock hold that the telephone companies have over those smartphones.
One of the things you describe is there's a map on the Google campus that shows where people are doing Google searches, and it pretty much covers every place in the world where there's electricity.
That is, it's actually a stunning thing. It's flashing lights, and you'll see, you know, in Siberia you don't see many flashing lights or Greenland, obviously, but all over the world you see these lights flashing, and it's a stunning map to look at, and you realize that the dominance of a Google search and how important it is throughout their market share in the world, worldwide, is larger than it is in the United States. It's 70% worldwide.
Did you get any sense that Mr. Page and Mr. Brin were in danger of becoming bored with what they were doing? Are they still engaged and excited about coming in and dreaming up new things?
They're still engaged and excited, and they push their engineers. I mean, I would sit in meetings and be absolutely stunned at how they were never satisfied. They were always pushing their engineers to be bolder. And so they have that. They haven't lost that passion. On the other hand, they're now 36. They're recently married, recently become dads, recently acquired their own 767 airplane. And one of the things to watch for is, do the two founders of Google decide that it's time to, with family responsibilities now and having worked so hard these past two decades, to start smelling the roses a little bit? And will that divert their attention from Google? That's one of the questions that I pose in the book, and we can't know the answer to that yet. But what I do know the answer to, having observed them, is they remain very passionate and always dissatisfied.
Let's see. Let's take another phone call real quick here. We've only got about a minute left. Mike in Prairie du Chien. Mike,
yeah,
good morning.
I have a quick one here. Do they record names, addresses, phone numbers, and I understand they even have satellite pictures of your domicile, houses, property? And if so, can you make a contact to get that removed out of the memory bank?
There is no, they do not have your name. Unless you subscribe to Google Checkout, when they would have, that's the purchase stuff, they would have your name and address and credit card information on that, the way Apple or Amazon does. But otherwise, a Google search, there's a cookie for each search. They don't know your name, but they know your zip code, and they know everything you searched, everything you've read, every ad you've clicked on, everything you've purchased. but they do not know your name. And on the houses on Google Earth and stuff and Street View, they don't have your name associated with those houses. But if you want to opt out of the cookie, you can as a user. Yes.
Yeah, and I can see your house from my house, provided I know where you live.
That's right.
Okay. Well, listen, this has just been a fascinating hour, and it's a fascinating book, and I'm sure you had a great time writing it.
Oh, I had. It was delicious. It was just, it's amazing that people pay me to have such fun.
Well, I often say the same thing when I'm hosting a talk show. But I do like to get paid. Note to management, I'm not doing this for free. Ken Auletta, thank you for spending an enjoyable hour with us and our listeners here this morning.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
The book is Googled, The End of the World as We Know It by Ken Auletta, whose other books include Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. Of course, he's the writer of the Annals of Communication column in The New Yorker. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Erica Janik handled on-air production. If you missed part of it, want to go back and hear the whole thing over again, go to WPR.org and navigate your way to the Kathleen Dunn page, and you should be able to find today's programs there. Stick around. Jim Packard's in for Larry Mueller next. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.